Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good afternoon. Thank you all so much for coming along to our event today, to our Capital Markets Day, our first Capital Markets Day. I've never done one before, so if I go wrong, please, excuse me for that. So just to set the scene, the reason you're here and what's going on out there and the connection to it, as some of you may know, one of our group companies is Disruption. Disruption organised this event here today, the Disruption Summit. And the reason we acquired Disruption was largely to become the marketing platform for our group companies, to give them a marketing platform they could only dream of. It's been our mantra for a long time. And as you see today, it's very much playing out. So today, five of our companies are exhibiting. There's a conference track over there related to public sector where Josh just counted. I think there are 140 people in the conference track. Great lineup of speakers, great delegates, a great platform for us to market our company from. Clearly, as a relatively new company, if we tried to put an event on like this, there are something like 500 people out there. Altogether, if we tried to put an event on like this, we'd have never been able to pull it off. So actually, by buying Disruption, owning that, and having PA Consulting kindly pay for the event for us, it gives us a fantastic marketing platform for ourselves. So that's why you're here. In terms of what we're going to do, Ollie and I are going to take you through a slide deck, just to take you through our results for the last financial year, as well as a little about what we're up to today, now. And then Dom is somewhere. Wherever you are. Oh, there you are. We'll talk a little about FutureGov and our plans in the public sector. And then David Biden, wherever he is, somewhere there at the back. We'll talk about Human Plus, which is our robotic process automation services company. And then Ronald Ashby, who's actually doing another workshop just next door right now. We'll come and talk about GreenSheet Labs, chatbots, and so on. After Ollie and I have spoken, we'll give you an opportunity to ask some questions. Then we'll have Dom, and then some questions, then David and questions, and then Ronald, and then some questions. So without any further ado, we are the Panoply, and we're here to empower positive, sustainable digital transformation. Now, the powerful words there, everyone's in digital transformation, the real powerful words for us are positive and sustainable. We are at an inflection point, a junction in the technology industry. Where we go from here is a series of conscious choices. You know, you've seen the organizations like Facebook and Google come under intense scrutiny for their attitude to privacy. Increasingly, we believe that those same organizations will come under intense scrutiny for their attitude to climate change. It is a little known fact that the reality is that the technology industry probably accounts for about the same carbon emissions as the aviation industry today, if not more, and is growing at a far faster pace. We are at a point of choice, and in the business that we're in, which is helping our clients on their digital transformation journey, it's a point of choice where we want to help them make the right decisions for the future, for their businesses and also for broader communities. We've said from the outset that we're here to provide a purpose-driven alternative to the big 20th century monoliths. I've sat in a presentation earlier today from a large organization, talking about decentralized, talking about decision-making at the edges, talking about foundation or organizations being able to move very quickly, and yet it was all coming from a very monolithic 20th century staid organization. The reality is that today's kind of requirements are very different, and we've been purpose-built from the outset to be a 21st century organization helping our clients solve 21st century problems. We talk about, in our vision, we talk about people and organizations. So we're not just here to help our clients embark upon the journey. We're also here to help their people through the change that journey means in terms of the fourth industrial revolution and the overall digital transformation journey. As for the numbers, so some of you will know that we announced our results a few weeks ago, and the revenue to the year ending 31st of March 19, keep it ahead of my years, was 22.1 million against an expectation in the market of 21.1, so it was great news. EBITDA 3.5 million against an expectation of 3, So again, great news. And 191 clients against 162 in the year before. It is worth saying that that 3.5, that half a million over that we experienced was largely down to one particular client spending a huge amount, way faster than we ever anticipated. And they have now returned to more normal levels of spend. So, you know, yes, a great result, but a bit of a bumper year really for us as we came out with our maiden results. One of the things we track, of course, is growth. Growth, overall revenue growth, 42%, of which 38% was organic growth. The other 4% related to the acquisitions that we did after the IPO period. All the numbers that we talk about are pro forma on the basis that we'd owned the companies for the full 12-month period. From a statutory perspective, the four acquisitions closed on the IPO day itself, on the 4th of December. And so all the numbers in the statutory results actually reflect the fact that we only own the companies for the four-month period, approximately four-month period. Operating EBITDA, excluding central costs, was 4.4 million. That's a key number. Obviously, this year, in the current financial year and since the IPO, central costs have increased to take into account the fact that we're a PLC today. But also, we've built a platform for growth, and we will talk about that in a bit more detail later on. People always say to us, we are a consulting business, you have no recurring revenue, which is relatively true, there is a bit. But generally, we do win project by project from our clients. But what we tend to find is that once you're in a client, if you're doing a great job, you tend to stick around for an awfully long time. Clients go through ebbs and flows, but typically we end up invoicing clients for many years over the time from when we win them. So as an example of that, something like 45% of customers that we billed in 2017, we also billed in 18 and also billed in 19. And similarly, 18, 68% of customers that we billed in 18, we also billed in 19 as well. So it's not recurring, but it does repeat on a reasonably regular basis. I've met most of you, bear with me for those who've heard this a few times before. So my own background, I've been in and around technology for a long time. I found the internet, luckily, in 1994, 1995. Started an internet consultancy, grew that to 50 people, sold it to a NASDAQ-listed company, started a managed service company that was eventually sold for £72 million, and then also built one of India's first agile software companies, grew that to 800 people across India, Eastern Europe and South Africa in 5 years. And then in 2016, started thinking about what's the future of the technology services landscape, recognized that clients which were using 20th century providers to solve 21st century problems, they were looking for speed and agility, were turning to slower organizations to get them there. So hence we started. Along that journey, met Ollie, and you can do the rest.
Sure. Hi, guys. My name's Ollie Rigby. I'm the CFO and co-founder of The Panoply. My background is I was an accountant for 3 years. Fortunately, I wasn't a brilliant accountant, so I moved on as quickly as possible after qualifying and moved into the city where I focused on listing businesses on AIM. So I was an AIM nomad for about 6 years before moving into industry and setting up a part-time CFO business across a range of sectors. So I did that for about 5 years, but always looking to find a business to bring back to market, particularly one that had an M&A focus. And I met Neil in September 16, and we started the Panoply in December 16. So that's my background. We've got Jim in the audience. So if we've got a microphone, it's just worth actually just quickly introducing Jim. Jim's at the front.
Hi, I'm Jim. Did that for me. Jim Bowser. I run a business called The Manifesto in the group, but I'm also Chief Innovation Officer for the group. So I'm the gobby one. I present a podcast called Alexa Stop, which is about how technology is changing people's lives. And I provided some of the jazz hands on the IPO roadshow.
Sarah is at the back, so perhaps we can just introduce Sarah as well. Yeah.
You turn around. I'm Sarah Vick. I'm the Chief of Staff at the Panoply. I've spent the last 20 years primarily growing digital agencies around the world. Worked in Singapore and Australia. I was the Managing Director of a business called Reading Room that exited to a number of different businesses. Exited to iDocs, exited to EY last year, before joining the Panoply to grow this business.
Brilliant. And then on to Mark, who's our chairman.
Hello, yes, as it says up there, I'm the non-executive chairman of the Panoply. I'm also a non-executive director of another AIM-listed company called the Dodds Group, and I'm chairman of a private company called Holiday Extras, which hopefully most of you will use if you go on holiday. My background, I spent most of my working life as a founder of Chime Communications, which floated originally for just over £20 million, and we finally sold to private equity for nearly £400 million in the end. So I'm hoping the Panoply can achieve something similar. Thank you.
Brilliant. Isabel, so when Neil and I were setting up this business, we had some spreadsheets, and the spreadsheets showed us making loads of money, which was really interesting and fun. But we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just about that and that we had purpose at the heart of everything we did. We were at the time working with Isabel, who was consulting with us to look a little bit around how we built purpose into the organisation. And one thing she said to me is that purpose is always normally something that sits at the bottom of a board agenda, and actually it should be at the top. And I thought, well, actually, if we're going to talk about it properly, then we should have one on the board who really is the voice of purpose. So Isabel provides that. She established the Salesforce Foundation globally and ran Salesforce Foundation in Europe for many years. So she's a great addition. Chris Sweetland, our final non-exec, was the deputy CFO at WPP for 17 years or something like that. Oversaw something like 300 acquisitions in his time. And what he doesn't know about public companies, it's not worth knowing. I joke about the fact that our audit committee is made up of Mark and Chris, and it's probably the most scary audit committee any company could ever have picked. But they are a hugely invaluable board, and I think we've got a really, really strong board as we go forward and grow the business. Just to talk, for those who haven't or don't know the background to the business, it's been, I guess, a pretty rapid journey to get to where we are now. So we incorporated the company in December 16. Neil and I then spent most of 2017 running around the UK meeting companies with a PowerPoint presentation talking about the opportunity that we saw and meeting businesses that we thought might be a good fit for our group. We met something like 100 companies over the course of 2016 and then into 2017. And that resulted in us completing the acquisitions or completing SPAs that were conditional on an IPO in about May of last year. We then spent most of the summer building towards the IPO and marketing at the back end of 2018, and we successfully completed the IPO and raised £5 million in December 2018. The four acquisitions completed at that date. And then between the 4th of December and Christmas, we managed to complete another acquisition, which was for a business called Deeson, as well as getting our interim results out. And I can recommend never ever trying to do those two things in 1 month, or those three things in 1 month again. After the year ends, we completed the acquisition of Disruption. Neil set the scene for those guys here. We can talk a bit more about the companies in a bit. And then in February, we acquired Green Shoot Labs. They're going to be speaking later, so you get feedback on them, as well as launching our first business internally. And we've got David here, who's going to talk later about Human Plus. And then finally, after the year end, we acquired FutureGov, our biggest acquisition to date. And Dom's going to talk you through that as well. At the time we did the FutureGov deal, we also entered into a £5 million facility, or raised a £5 million facility with HSBC, of which we've drawn down £3.5 million to date. And that facility is for further acquisitions and working capital.
So why do we exist? And I guess largely because this is what clients are telling us. Clients are telling us that they want scale, but they also want deep specialism. They're fed up of young grads being thrown at projects and not really getting the outcomes that they're looking for. They want boldness, they want agility and speed, they want the vision, but they also want the ability to execute at scale and deliver on large scale projects. They want the innovation, but they also want some discipline in the way that that innovation is delivered. They want flexibility, but they also need some structure to work with. They want the startup thinking, but they also need the financial stability. They need to know that when they entrust a company with some of these pivotal projects, that the company is going to be around in the years to come. And they want that deep sectoral expertise, but they also want to learn from other sectors. And you'll see here, one of the tracks that we're, the track that we're running is a track that's loosely called what the commercial sector can learn from government. And, it's probably the opposite of what people imagine, but actually we see lots of learning there and we want to take that into other sectors as well. And that's what the clients are actually looking for. So in order to solve all those problems, we came together, as Ollie said, in December 18. to create the company that we are today. As of the end of June, we were 340 people across Europe. And as I said earlier, the revenue growth was 42% year on year, which 38% was organic. Our group, so again, for those of you who don't know us, I'll quickly take you through. Benegger, our Norwegian-based management consultancy, with a specialism in digital transformation. The reason we acquired that company, we have a goal of setting up regional clusters of companies, of complementary companies. The reason to want to own a management consultancy is because they typically have those C-suite relationships that we know that if you get the likes of Jim and the others in front of the C-suite, they tend to be wowed by the kind of the knowledge, the capability. It's a refreshing change from the normal people that get typically get put in front of them. And so we want to leverage that, and we'll talk a bit more about our expansion over time. Deason, Ollie talked to, hugely complementary company in terms of the capability to Manifesto, which again we'll talk about, but in a couple of adjacent sectors, specifically arts, museums as being something that they're particularly involved with, including the royal household, as I understand as well, so it's really good. Disruption, you see, so we bought Disruption because we wanted a marketing platform. We always wanted a content-led marketing strategy. We always knew that the way that you get the right kind of people, and this room is full of head of digital, head of innovation, CIO, CTO, CEO of many organizations that you'll have heard of, something like 500-odd people in here today. You know, if we'd have tried to do that from scratch, it would have cost us millions. And the reality is that Disruption have it. They have a database of 17,500 people. The reality is there's about 4,500 of those that you'd really want. But, you know, out of that, we get to create events like this, round tables, dinners, sponsored dinners, the magazine itself that you've seen. You've seen the magazine if you've got a copy of the red, this magazine here. Somewhere in here is an article on conversational interfaces and conversational AI, which happens to have been written by Ronald Ashry, who you'll hear from in a bit. So it's a case of subtly weaving our marketing message in to a trusted platform that our audience is already reading. FutureGov, or you'll hear from Dom later on FutureGov itself, but really there to help us really grow our public sector business. Our public sector business this year is anticipated to be circa 45% of overall revenue. So big growth area for us. Greenshoot Labs you'll hear about as well, Human Plus you will. Manifesto Jim's talked about, really a strong focus on the customer interaction and the experience side of digital transformation, with a particular emphasis on not-for-profits as a client base. Not Binary are very much that back end, heavy lifting, cloud-based engineering company, helping the likes last year of DVLA on their journey away from their big mainframes towards cloud-native software to enable them to really modernize. And Questers is our engine room for the group. So the way we see it is it's Eastern European-based in Bulgaria, and they're there to provide talent not only for our clients, but also for the group itself. And the example of that right now is Human Plus, where it's a startup within the organization, and they've been set up effectively to leverage the Eastern European talent pool. So as they scale, they'll be hiring more and more of their staff actually in the Bulgarian office. Now, one of the challenges, of course, for a group like ours is how do you maximize the sales leverage that comes from owning all this capability? Perhaps the best example, I'll sort of switch to education as an example of this. So if you take education today, across the companies, Human Plus is working with UCL, Not Binary is working with London South Bank University, Manifesto is working with Dundee, Greensheet Labs is working with Brunel, all on different projects in and around transformation of those organizations. In our head, we think, well, how do we maximize the sales leverage of having those great case studies and being able to sell the entire capability of the group? So what you'll see us do is really focus on verticalizing our offer and driving that as a go-to-market message. So the first example of that is Dom, as part of coming into the group, is taking on a role of managing director of public sector and health. But you'll see us do more and more of that in order to drive our entire capability right the way through into those customers and cross-sell in the maximum way. Our services, again, for those that don't know us, we don't report by individual companies. And the reason for that is because we tend to find that a company's involvement in a project might be small, but it's actually quite pivotal to the success of that project. And so rather than sort of report those on an individual basis, we report our numbers by these five big service lines, if you like. Experiences, everything from service and UX design all the way through to user research and so on and so forth. So that whole, how does a customer use or a user use the software that has been created? XaaS was something that Jim came up with, I have to say. We needed a catch-all, and it kind of stands for anything as a service. But it covers everything from talent to cloud transformation, distributed software development, agile coaching, and so on. Intelligence is everything from what we call relatively low-level BI, so things like Power BI and tools like that, and Tableau and tools like that, right the way through to machine learning and artificial intelligence. Transformation is the work that the likes of FutureGov and Ben Aguirre do, which is helping the client through that transformational journey, not just the technology, but also the organizational design, the change management, and then right the way through to the whole program definition and so on. And then automation, which largely for us means robotic process automation, but also chatbots. And so the example of Brunel, Green Street Labs wrote some software for them that enables them to largely automate the clearing process. So you can imagine a university, A-level results day, massive inbound inquiries. They largely automated much of that, and that's kind of where that would sit. So in summary of how we work, some of you will have heard me talk about our decentralized operating model. The image we like to conjure up for people is a murmuration of starlings. So if you imagine the birds as they swoop around, we swarm around our clients and our projects and their projects. We create the right team for them in real time. There's no discernible command and control and bureaucracy getting in the way, which means we can act at the pace at which the client is now looking for us to act, so that our clients can access, today hundreds of experts, benefit from the scale and the financial stability of the group, and yet not get bogged down in that rigid corporate culture that they really want to fight across. Most of our clients want to speed up. It makes no sense at all to work with an organization that hasn't yet speeded up. And so we provide the answer to that.
Can we do this one? Just talk a little bit about purpose. So we mentioned Isabel at the start in terms of building purpose into everything we're looking to do. Our first hire into the central team after we floated was to bring Bryony on board. In fact, Bryony, you're here. Why don't you talk a little bit really quickly about some of the stuff? I've just dropped you in that, haven't I? Completely dropped you in it, but mate.
So we separate out our purpose work into communities, people and planet. And we're looking at ways in which we can make a positive impact on all of those pieces. So in terms of people, we're looking specifically at diversity and inclusion and have lots of targets across the group about how we might better integrate some of those initiatives. So we're having unconscious bias training at the moment for all of our hiring managers globally, and working on several locally specific programs as well in terms of D&I. For our planet, we are about to launch a campaign next week as part of the global strike action, in order to look more about the impact that the digital economy has in terms of our carbon footprint.
So we just granted to the Green Web Foundation, and we will be training people internally to be able to do digital audits to see where the carbon happens in the digital supply chain, to be able to make better choices internally and also advocate for better solutions for our clients. So we're seeing that as a business development opportunity as well. And then finally, on communities, we're launching a programme next month for young entrepreneurs, so looking at investing in a pipeline of more diverse talent so that our boardrooms look a lot more diverse in the next 10 to 15 years.
Thanks, Brandy, that's awesome. Right. Take that one. So just to bring a couple of those things to life, Neil and I have probably met 200 companies or something like that over the course of this journey to look to bring into the group. And of those 200 companies, I think we've met two companies with female board representation. or something along those lines, being outrageous. So that's something that we're really keen to try and focus on. The planet one's really interesting. I've got a stat here that apparently 10% of the world's electricity goes on digital, the internet. And apparently that digital video streaming has had a larger carbon footprint last year than Spain. So it's just interesting that a lot of people don't talk about the impact that technology is having around the planet and carbon. So that's something that we're keen to advocate and look at and drive forward in our discussions. The one other thing just to mention, sorry, is that it's been instrumental, I think, in the group of companies that we've brought together. So we've always, in every meeting we ever have, we talk about our values, which are being entrepreneurial and creative, which we think is what the client needs. Set against being ego-free, which is always a difficult one to find in entrepreneurially-led businesses. So it's that sort of move to ego aside. And finally, the fourth one is being conscious. And so we talk about that. And that has really led to all the businesses joining being very focused on purpose. And I think it's not... You see we have a 20% of our revenue is in the not-for-profit space. We see a long a significant portion of our revenue this year as well as last year being around government as well, and you know the people that we have within our group that work within our group are very passionate about the impact that they're having in the work that they do, and so having purpose at our core has really attracted the businesses and the group of people that we have around us today. And here's Isabel, by the way, who's just walked in. Hi, Isabel. If anyone would like to meet her afterwards. Cool.
So just to dwell on purpose for a minute. So, you know, people talk today about 21st century organisations having to have purpose embedded, attracting a millennial workforce, retaining a millennial workforce. And the reality is for us, because we've said this from the outset, we want to be a purpose-driven organisation from the outset. It is worth noting that, you know, of the companies that we've acquired, we've seen no change in levels of staff turnover from the point at which we acquire them. Our companies seem to find it not easy, but certainly seem to be able to find the talent that they're looking for. We're pretty sure that having a purpose embedded is part of that. We know for sure that FutureGov would not have come to our group. Dom had a number of opportunities, but FutureGov would not have come into our group if it wasn't for this purpose. I know the same goes for Manifesto, the same goes for Decent. You know, we are building a great community of like-minded individuals, and I think as a consequence of that, we're setting ourselves up for a better commercial future as a consequence of that. So I do see the connection between being purpose-driven and profitability as being something that's completely intertwined for the future.
So just to look at a little bit at last year in terms of revenue split, as I mentioned, 22% in the not-for-profit space, 44% in commercial and 33% in government. That's where we saw the strongest growth, from 13% in the year before up to 33%. See some of our clients on the left-hand side. One of the things that we found interesting is that since the IPO and the groups coming together, particularly one of our businesses, Quest, has started to move its client base away from sort of SMEs up to sort of more bigger enterprise customers, such as News UK and Cargill, the two recent customers that we've seen win. I think it's fair to say that it's early stage still in terms of bringing the businesses together and getting the sales collaboration really working. But I think you'll find across the entities there's significant willing, which is really important. I think we've already started. I think in the year to March 19, we had 7 group collaborative clients within that sort of 4 or 5 month period post IPO. So starting to work well.
We've got a couple of case studies, but rather than dwell on them now, so we've got Ronald Ashby that will come and talk about this in particular, and also the work that Green Street Labs are doing, particularly around Open Dialogue, which is the first piece of IP that we actually have within the group that we've open sourced. But I won't talk to this too much now. I think Ronald will explain it far better than me. So in terms of our group, our key differentiators I would say that the fact that we're purpose-driven is a huge differentiator out for us in the market. Again, another presentation that took place out there, the keynote for the whole day, talked about purpose being one of the 4 big levers of success for organisations moving forward. We've embedded it from the very beginning, and it's proving to be, as I say, a huge commercial advantage to us. Our values: entrepreneurial, creative, ego-free, and conscious. We recognise that nobody is ego-free. What it really means is it's designed to provoke the discussion, which says you know when to leave your ego at the door. And, you know, when we look out across, we had an annual kickoff meeting at the beginning of the financial year, where we had the leadership teams of all the group companies in the room, something like 30, 35 people in the room. And when you look out across a group of people who are committed to a purpose, who have the same values, you pretty much know you can do anything that you set your mind to. And that certainly, this is not values as one of those tick box exercises that says, yes, I had a company years ago where I didn't understand all this stuff. And I had a company years ago, and we had all our values across our name tags on the badges. I couldn't have even repeated them to you. But the reality is that we've been saying these words and we've been living this from December 16 onwards, and it really is embedded as part of the organization today. You know, we talk about sales collaboration. It is early days, but I tell you what, when you see on Slack, and we, you know, everyone's on the same Slack channels, when you see on Slack a photograph at Aylesbury train station of a joint pitch team turning up, or at Kingston, Royal Borough of Kingston, Sutton, is that right, the other day? You know, when you see these photographs popping up on your Slack and you see these people are really working and committed towards collaboration, I think we are collaborative to the core. Talked about our Starling operating model, the decentralized operating model. The pace of technology is such that I can't possibly have all the answers. There's no way. And so it is about putting the ego aside. It's about distributing the capability and the decision-making out across the organization so we can move at the pace at which clients are looking for us to move at. Oh, by the way, profitable, cash generative. Unlike many organizations that are focused on AI and robotics and RPA and all these other kind of exciting technology areas, we do make money. And we've got a very focused growth strategy. Talking of growth strategies, our goal is to create regional clusters of complementary companies. So today we've got the UK, we've got Nordics, and we've got Eastern Europe. Our goal is to create a Nordic cluster, a Benelux cluster, a German cluster, and perhaps other clusters over time as well. So we're actively looking for companies to add to the group. We have an acquisition formula, which we can take you through at some point. We have an acquisition formula that we follow. Every single deal so far has followed the acquisition formula. But the biggest thing we're looking for is that adherence or buy-in to our values and who we are and what we're looking to do. This is not an exit for any company that joins the group. So when we go and meet these companies, and actually I might as well move to the pipeline, we've got a significant pipeline of acquisitions that we're talking to today. We've put Sasha Rook is somewhere here maybe. Sasha was a founder of NotBinary, but also now runs M&A or is responsible for M&A for the group. We have our M&A analyst. We're doing all of our own deal origination. We're a research analyst working across Europe, finding companies for us to talk to. So a significant M&A pipeline. But the first thing we do in every first meeting is we say, this is not an exit. This is the next stage of growth for your company. If you want to make some money and go run off to the beach, then there are better places for you to go because this isn't it. And we're super clear about that. We're super clear about our values. And that's how I think we're getting the kind of caliber of companies that we've got into the group. You'll see there a significant pipeline of acquisitions nearing 200 million of revenue. This is not in any way to say that any of those will be done and completed. That's the disclaimer bit, the small print. But what it effectively shows you is that we are talking to a large number of companies. We're typically looking for companies between 3 and 10 million revenue. There are a few in there that are bigger, but we're typically looking for, actively searching for companies with between 3 and 10 million revenue that either have a vertical market focus or have a particular niche technology capability that we can plug into the model.
So when we came to market, we talked about growth in a couple of areas. One was through acquisition, one was organic growth. In terms of organic growth, we look to invest into the companies we buy. So these are some of the investments that we've made since the start of the year. So we obviously launched Human Plus. You'll get a very good introduction into that in a second. We launched Questa's RPA alongside that to find RPA engineers who could deliver growth for Human Plus as well as other clients. Cargill are now a client of that business. There's a lack of RPA capability across the sector, and so we see that as an opportunity. For Manifesto, we've launched the Bristol office as well as .NET capability out of that office. So it's another regional pool of talent for us, as well as we have a number of clients in the West Country. So it makes sense from that perspective. I also live in Bristol, which was definitely part of the investment decision. Green Shoot Labs, again, we'll talk a bit about that, but that was a startup that joined our group. And we paid no money for that business at acquisition, but has an earn-out period, and we're investing with those guys to help grow that business. The Summit, so Disruption is a loss-making business, but as you can see, there's no way we could have generated anything like today without having brought those guys on board. Again, it's nothing we paid £50,000 for that business in shares at completion. We're investing into them and hoping to grow them over the long term, and hopefully certainly make it a cost-neutral marketing platform for us as a group. When we brought in FutureGov, they've got some health capability in the business, but keen to push forward with that and promote that more. We've just agreed to invest in some new business development capability within that business. And then finally, in terms of our central team, within the holding company, it was this time a year ago, Neil and Diana. We've brought in some more finance capability, Luke, marketing, and obviously Bryony, who you met before, so invested into our team. So those are some of the things we've done since IPO. Just Neil's really run through these numbers. I think key points to note are they are pro forma numbers. We presented pro forma numbers to try and make it as easy as possible for you guys to look at the group. We did it for our IPO. So in the IPO document, we had the results for the four businesses that were acquired at the point of acquisition aggregated. In the year to March 18, they did 15.6 million revenue. Those four companies effectively did about 21.5 million this year, and then there's about 0.6 that relates to the acquisition of Disruption, Deeson, and Green Shoot Labs. So yeah, as we talked about, that 42% increase in revenue, 38% was organic. EBITDA has performed strongly. We finished the year with a strong cash balance. Obviously, since the IPO, we completed the acquisition of FutureGov. That was every acquisition we've done today has been on a solely share-for-share basis. FutureGov had a slightly unusual shareholder base in that it had Nesta and Surrey County Council as major shareholders, neither of whom were able to hold public stock. So we had to buy them out for cash. And in order to complete that deal, we used about $1.5 million of our cash, and then $3.5 million of cash from HSBC. The rest was on a share for share basis, and certainly the management team took 90% of their value in shares. Just to summarise, I guess when we came round the IPO, and Neil may have some more to say, but when we came to the IPO, we talked about being an acquisitive business. We've done four acquisitions since IPO. We've got a strong pipeline for future M&A. We talked about creating a group with organic growth, and that's certainly been delivered in our first year. We talked about investing in purpose, and that's certainly something that's really at the heart of everything we do. And we talked about investing in the group companies to allow them to grow beyond their earnouts, and that's something that we're also working with, and we think we've got a strong management team.
So just to look to the year that we're in at the moment, obviously you've seen that we've made a number of investments in this first half in particular, so we see the year from a profitability perspective being strongly second half weighted, as those investments begin to come through. So if you take Human Plus as an example, that's growing at a significant rate. We anticipate it may well be break even during the second half. However, if it continues to grow at the rate that it's continued to grow at, it may well require some additional investment. So certainly for the year ahead, for the current period, the current half year, then as I say, we see those investments playing out, and therefore, as I say, it being second half weighted. For the year itself, I would say that we are cautiously optimistic. In terms of the whole year, we 45% of our revenue is in public sector now, and as you know, that there's a few things going on in government at the moment, and you know, and it's not particularly predictable as to how that will land, but we did look at it. We looked at our pipeline, our public sector pipeline, and in aggregate across the entire public sector pipeline across our companies. We think we assessed it each line on a line-by-line basis against its risk of delay as a consequence of an election being called. So this purdah period where typically new contracts are not awarded, particularly at central government level. And to be very precise, 4.36% of our total unweighted pipeline is at risk as a consequence of that. So as I say, we're cautiously optimistic for the year ahead. Any questions?
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my question. You talk about creating a community of like-minded individuals. However, the individuals themselves are not like. So I just wondered how you engender group-wide thinking and best behaviours in terms of working on combined projects and cross-selling through a community of essentially entrepreneurs.
Sure, that's a really good question. Having experienced it myself, I did an earnout many, many years ago, and all I did was went like this and thought about my earnout and didn't care about any other part of the group. I was very focused on my formula, which clearly told me that the formula was wrong. So if you look at our acquisition formula today, a significant proportion of the earnout parts of that formula are payable upon the entrepreneurs generating collaborative revenue. So A hits in the pocket, and it's disproportionate. I mean, we require only 5% of revenue to come from collaboration, a minimum of 5% of revenue to come from collaboration. But it makes the behavior happen because it's a disproportionate sum. We also double count. So two companies in earnout, they both get to count that collaborative revenue towards their 5%. So it's kind of encouraging the behavior. I've been in sales and marketing and sales for long enough to know that you get the behavior you pay for. And certainly we're prepared to do that. That's part of the acquisition formula that we talk about. The other thing, though, is you know, everybody's a common shareholder in the group. And today, with something like 80% of the shares are owned by the founder entrepreneur group and staff. And we've been very clear from the outset with every company we've met and every company we've brought into the group that the city cares about 1+1=3 or more. And the way you demonstrate that is through collaborative sales. We're not about cost cutting and shaving a few points of margin here and there. We're about actually creating a platform for further growth. And so everybody fully understands that their future wealth is completely tied up in proving that. And so again, that generates the behavior. And then perhaps the third area is, you know, we look hard at those values and ego-free in particular, where we say to our entrepreneurs, yes, entrepreneurial and creative, we want that that entrepreneurialism to retain, to still be there, but also be aware that ego-free is that. And so far, everybody we've brought in has bought into those values as well. So it's a kind of three-pronged answer to stopping that kind of very blinkered earnout type behaviour that we've all seen many, many times.
Could I ask a quick follow-on? How do you take sort of a project on digital transformation in the public sector and drop it into the private sector? Is there enough commonality of process, people, product?
I think Dom should have that one.
I currently haven't done it personally, but for me, like, we've been into different organisations, and some of my team have as well, particularly proximate organisations, so the regulated industries like banking and elsewhere, and we're really confident that the approach that we've honed over 11 years in FutureGov is highly replicable into the private sector. So I'll talk about our approach in a minute, but for me, I think it's pretty much identical, and those are the areas that I'd be interested in us getting to next, around utilities, banking, etc., that have those commonalities of, like, deeply embedded legacy systems and culture, often previously public sector organisations turned private. But yeah, that's where we're focusing, I think.
I think there was a question.
I know. Just more on the earnouts. Can you claw back any equity if one of the portfolio companies doesn't perform? And just on the loan, if you can provide any detail on the terms of that loan from HSBC.
Sure. Shall I take that one? So the way the acquisition formula works is that we value a business based on its historic trading EBITDA on the point it enters the group. We then revalue the business 12 months after the acquisition and a further 12 months after that. And at those valuation points, we fully pay for any uplift in value, but we also have the ability to claw back any value that we've given during those periods as well. So if I give you a quick example, if a business came into the group with 0.5 million of EBITDA, typically we pay about 6x EBITDA for a business. So in that scenario, 500,000 times 6 would get you to a 3 million valuation. If that business grows to 0.7 million in the year after acquisition, then there's a £200,000 gap times 6 is 1.2 million of additional consideration we would pay. If it then grows to 0.9, again, it's increased by another 200,000 from the year before, so another 1.2 million of consideration. If we were to work an example the other way around, where we bought a business which was doing 0.9 million at the point we bought it, we'd pay 5.4 for that. If it then dropped to 0.7 in the year after acquisition, we would claw back and cancel £1.2 million worth of shares at that point. And similarly, if it dropped again to 0.5, we would claw back. Beyond that point, the earnout's finished in our transactions. The second question was around HSBC. So HSBC have provided a £5 million facility. It's a revolving credit facility. So there is there's a fee for any for when we if we draw down the money, we pay, I think, 2.5% plus LIBOR for money drawn down. And there's a 1% non-utilization fee for money not drawn. The money can be drawn down for future acquisitions, subject to kind of their approval of the deal. Not approval of the deal, but understanding the rationale and understanding the impact it will have on our finances. Or it can be used for working capital if it's needed across the group as well. Up to 1.5 of it can be used for working capital.
Just returning to the multiple of EBITDA that you use, a couple of points. If the EBIT, since the introduction of IFRS 16, EBITDAs are generally being stated higher because of the treatment of leases. Is that factored in your calculation of EBITDA?
Yeah, we reflect EBITDA on a traditional basis rather than under IFRS 16.
That's good to hear. And what about central costs and an allocation of those costs across the different companies? Is that reflected in the EBITDA?
No, it's not reflected in the EBITDA in terms of how we pay for it. The central costs are the central costs. And there is obviously a management charge that flows through to the entities, but that is added back as an exceptional.
Thank you.
Hey, so if this is new for Neil, then you can trust me when I say this is totally, totally new for me as a government bureaucrat turned entrepreneur. So great to meet you all. As you've heard, my name's Dominic Campbell. I run FutureGov. We've been around now for 11 years, started back in 2008. As you would imagine, things were rather different in terms of digital transformation 11 years ago. And it was much more about teaching people Twitter and hashtags rather than actually getting our hands on big organisations and making deep and fundamental change. So in many ways, we've both driven and tracked the nature of government transformation and the market in that regard, which I'll talk to. We're obsessed with radically redesigning government organisations, institutional reform. As I say, my background was being a government policy wonk and then got into IT transformation, as you do, and then became obsessed with how can we rethink the way that we're doing IT-led change in government. There was, at the time, many reports from people like the National Audit Office and elsewhere that were saying 70% of IT programs fail in government, which felt bonkers to me. But a lot of it driven by both the sort of rigidity of the what were then increasingly old school technology solutions available to us to make change within government, but equally the ways of working and the way that we went about making change happen, very top down, very user centered. And for me, I set off from on the FutureGov journey, having left government, really to try and explore initially whether there was something else out there. I'd learned a great deal from spending time looking at the emerging nature of digital change in the private sector and was fairly convinced that this sort of relational nature, the much more human nature of change and design that could be enabled by the internet, enabled by professions like service design and user research, had massive opportunity for radically transforming public services. So that was really our founding nature. We've now worked with roughly 60% of the major local authorities in the UK. We've worked around the world in places like Australia, United Arab Emirates. We've had a partnership, we still have a partnership with a couple of international development agencies like UNDP, supporting cities in Indonesia, Philippines, Moldova, you name it. We've been around the world a few times. Over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a real consolidation of the market, a real opportunity for us, particularly in the UK. That sort of global nature of our outlook has enabled us to really work out where to double down, and the UK has been that place over the last couple of years in particular. It's hard to overstate how far ahead the UK is compared to other countries in terms of how design-led transformation in particular, enabled by digital technology, has taken hold, and the argument that has been made for that. You just have to go to the stream that we're holding next door, where it's the most popular stream here today, where people are, we've deliberately talked about how can the private sector learn from what's going on in public services. At no point in my 17-year career in government would that have been possible up until recently, where we can quite legitimately say, do you want to learn about how to do this stuff? Do you want to learn how technology can be more than this end of the equation type of purchase that you make, but actually fundamental to the way that your employees work and the services that you deliver? So as I say, we've been around over 10 years, gone through a fair few different iterations in some respects. So halfway through our journey, the reason why we had the weird and wonderful investor combination of Surrey and Nesta, who's a social impact investor, was that halfway through our journey, we'd done that inevitable thing as a digital organization of developing some products, almost as a side hobby to our digital transformation consultancy, and wanted to look to see whether we could scale those and pivot more towards a product company. I learned a lot about organization design, ironically, during that period, where the conflicting business models of consultancy and product under one roof was definitely a challenging proposition to manage, and certainly how much money you need to raise versus how much I had raised in order to make those things fly. So I feel like that was a really useful experience, particularly given the product offer that we have within the wider group and how best to manage product and consultancy when doing digital transformation. So actually 3 years ago, we said that was a great experiment, but actually our DNA and our passion is around design-led transformation of public service organisations enabled by digital tools. And so that's what we've really focused back down on over the last 3 years. We're obsessed with designing digital age organisations. Most organisations haven't been designed full stop, and they definitely haven't been, certainly in public services, haven't been designed for the internet age. They're certainly not working in squads. They're not working in agile ways. They don't understand these words that I'm saying right now most often. If it's not drawn as a triangle, then it's not a hierarchy that they understand, alongside governance, procurement, and a whole range of other areas of friction that, to be honest, I'm in awe of people who haven't got my background in government when they try and work to transform government, because all of those things are such specialist knowledge where you need the scars to be able to transcend them, which I think we do given our level of government expertise, as well as a whole range of people in our workforce who have worked in banks and other design agencies and large-scale transformation firms who bring that knowledge from elsewhere as well. Our focus is threefold, really. As I say, like we view ourselves as a change organisation. We're obsessed with the way people work together, ultimately. And in many respects, I don't really care how we get there. In this day and age, digital technology and human-centred design are the two preeminent tools by which we change organisations and make them more human-centred and appropriate for what we're trying to deliver. And that's across public services more than anywhere else. So we think very carefully about what is the political, financial, cultural, organisational setup that we're working with? What are the services that they're trying to deliver? Is it renew your driving licence? Is it support a family to adopt a child? And some of those other crunchy issues that we deal with. And then what role does technology play to supercharge that new type of way of working? As a diligent government nerd, I'm also obsessed with making sure that we rapidly get to a point of huge savings within the public sector. I believe when you look at innovations like SpaceX and the fact that they're doing what NASA was doing for 20% of the cost, why can we not get to that kind of business model shift and mindset shift across public services equally? And so that's the sort of, you know, the sort of greenfield end of our work at one regard, thinking pure blank piece of paper, what could this service look like built in the 21st century? Whereas the bulk of our work is the very hard arm wrestling brownfield work of trying to take these Victorian institutions somewhere closer to the 21st century. 20th century often would be a good start. This is broadly the way that we go about doing it and the sort of product offer that we provide to our clients across health and public services, helping them understand where they are right now in terms of organisational maturity assessment, vision and strategy roadmaps, give them some confidence in this as a new way of working. Up until really probably the last 2 years, it was still a, but what's so different? Why would we do it this way? Prove it, demonstrate a kind of world. Whereas now it's starting to tip into being, why wouldn't we do it that way? Which is great. So those demonstrator projects are becoming larger and much more mature for us in terms of giving organisations the confidence in working in a new way. We do an awful lot of capability building. We believe in sustainable government change, and that means government has to be able to stand on its own two feet once we've managed to get them in the right place and set them in the right direction. So we really want to make sure their workforces are in the right place to do that for themselves going forward. There's a lot that myself and other seniors in FutureGov do around leadership support, as well as, particularly since joining Panoply, working with others like NotBinary, being able to do the full suite of the sort of now what is now quite a mature government design process, taking it from discovery through to beta and live digital service delivery as well, which was one of the main attractions for me, I have to say, along with the wider purpose agenda within Panoply, was how can we bolster those gaps in our capability so that we're not just doing predominantly discovery and sort of prototype, but all the way through to live delivery, where previously we'd had to partner. Now we're part of a gang that can actually do the whole gamut together. Really, really wide range of organisations. I think as Neil talked about earlier, background in local government, definitely our stronghold still, where we've almost reached, being slightly boastful for a second, we've almost reached the level of we should FutureGov that, almost like we would Google that, in terms of what would FutureGov do to this, is almost where you get to when you work with councils now, because they know that we'll bring a different perspective. Ultimately, I say to them, if you want to get 3-5% savings and you know some Office 365, go and talk to somebody else. If you want to work with us around major savings, major change, enabled by that kind of technology, then we're your people. It isn't really a matter of adding another offer to the public service market that they compare the big four to. It's saying choose your favourite big four and then compare them to us and decide which world you want and which organisation you want to work with, which is what we see. As I say, we're desperate to make organise. The really brilliant thing about joining Panoply was the alignment between recognising that who we are and how we behave is vitally important, that there isn't this gap between us and who we are and what we're trying to persuade our clients to be and do. Like, we really do walk the talk and have the values and ways of working that people really want. And so they talk about how do we have our own in-house FutureGov, for instance, which for me is a win and exactly what I want us to achieve, because that means they see us as an exemplar organisation. The way we look at the world, we work at all levels, really. Yes, there are times where there's a point solution. We might put in an app, we might build something that solves a certain single issue, but we think about it all the way through service design, organisational transformation, and then equally all the way up to, which has always been my mission really, the reason I left government was to try and change all of government, not just one bit of it. How do we actually change the sector as a whole? And as I say, we've got teams that focus on all of those things but point to change ultimately. These are the skills and capabilities we've got. In the last year, we've invested particularly in back in our sort of management, classic management consultancy practice, but in an agile way. Our main differentiator, and you'll see our growth in a minute, I think, and one of the main reasons behind that has been we are one of the few of the new breed of agencies that clearly does the full stack change. Others will be a tech agency, others will be a design agency, and you'll get a lovely deck with some user research and a service design in it. But we're really the only ones, as our clients will say to us, that will do that, plus do the numbers. We will give them the business model analysis, we'll give them the business plan so that they can have confidence that this design solution and can actually extract the savings and change their organisation, which I think has been vitally important. And we're design and digital native, right? We're not, we haven't taken an audit firm and bolted on a technology practice and a design practice and hope nobody spots the gaps between these things. We're fundamentally, this is who we are and how we work and how we think, which I think is really different. As I say, we had a bit of an uptick. I think that's partly because we're really clever and also partly because the sector, which we've, you know, I would say we've definitely been there early. We've existed 3 years longer than the Government Digital Service. Me and others personally were involved in the conversations and the strategy behind getting government into the place where it is now. So it's probably not surprising that we've always really kept with our first mover advantage and kept listening and learning and making sure our offer is meeting the middle of the bell curve, but also leaning forwards to make sure that we deliver what's coming next. But we really took a step up in the last 2 years. And quick examples, building a case management system with social work, child protection workers in West London brings a lot of glee. A mad, huge turnout of pretty much everyone in that courtyard at Essex County Council, where we're turning Britain's second largest council, 1.2 million residents on its head, to help them think very differently about how they deliver services. It's about the way we work as much as it is about anything else. We're giving them hope, we're giving them change, we're giving them new ways of working and talking about public service delivery. And they're in a great deal more work in the health sector. We've just done a review of all urgent and emergency care around England. 20,000 organisations involved in urgent and emergency care. It was our job to work out how that can all be changed and how technology can play a stronger role within that. And then really in terms of where we might go forward, the consultancy.uk quote in there kind of popped out the page to me when you look at the potential. The consultancy market's still huge. The digital consultancy market within public services is growing exponentially, which is fantastic. I get endless feedback from our clients where they are now looking for our kind of offer, digital natives. The interesting thing about government as well is they've invested hugely in good people coming from the private sector into government positions. They now don't want frauds as their suppliers because they can suss it. They know legit. And so like that's why they like working with us, because they can see that we are them and they are us, and in a very modern way of doing government transformation. I think that's really important, and why we can sincerely offer something new compared to people who are 20th century dressed up in 21st century clothing. But yeah, so as I say, natural alternative, really interested in taking Homes England amongst others and doing it again and again to really be the leading organisation that goes beyond websites and into deep organisational change and service delivery, which is where our pedigree continues to be. So that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for Dom while we have him here?
I'm struck by two numbers. The number you've just put on the screen, 1.3 billion for 7 months, it's about 2 billion in a year. And then the 6 million that your part of the business turns over. And you said you're the go-to place for local government. 6 million out of 2 billion, I suspect that most people in local authority who are handing out contracts haven't heard of you. Have you slightly over-egged that?
It's interesting. Like, I would rather put that in the place of we've done the hard yards of building the organisation, doing some cutting-edge exemplars, which actually are the ones that aren't always the most, the biggest at times, rather than just selling them what they think they want. We've tended to specialise in something which is actually what they need. And that has led to us, in the first 7 or 8 years, not quite achieving where we could have done in many ways, because we're possibly 3 steps ahead. We've focused very clearly in the last 2 or 3 years to make sure that we're 1.5 steps ahead, and we're giving people the kind of challenge that they crave, whilst also delivering what they need here and now. For me, it's about doubling down on what we've done. I take your point around where the money is, but if you look at where the influence is, it's in a different place. And for me, the next 3 years is about reconciling that position. We have very strong brand recognition. We have very strong influence. great examples of delivery and of deep change focused on relatively few organisations, particularly over the last 2 or 3 years. We've gone smaller, deeper. And for me now, it's about scaling that up over the next 3 years to make sure there's less of a gap between who's known and who's delivering for the big money. And that's our real, that's my job for the next 3 years, really.
Hi there. A lot of London councils are complaining about cuts in government funding. How much of that is a help or a hindrance to your business?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I do think that that has had an influence on our uptick as well. It's, you know, whatever your opinion on austerity, it has definitely led to this phenomenon of it isn't enough to keep going to the people with the spreadsheets who tell us that we can save 2 or 3% if we just tighten this up and change our spending and have a slightly more efficient process here. They have had to come to us for slightly more radical reinvention.
As a result of that change, how long do your contracts last now compared with how they used to?
Yeah, I would say 3 years ago they were probably 3 month projects. These days I would and very much in the sort of 50 to 100 grand type projects. In the last 18 months, those are in like consistently in the, I would say, 2 to 400,000, 12 to 24 month type projects and engagements. And we're looking to push those out further. In the last year, we've had, I think, 4 multi-million pound projects at the sort of front end of our business development. And again, those, the Homes England one was interesting. That was a concentrated 12 month hit at the bulk of it. There was a sort of bell curve of spend, but that was multi-millions over a 12-month period. Team of 20 dropped into that organisation, which was half the size of their IT and change team. Those are the ones that we want to start to replicate and emulate, as well as making sure that we retain our sort of innovative, cutting-edge projects as well, which might be shorter and slightly less huge.
But also then capturing the technology spend that comes out of the end of it. So historically, you've partnered for that technology. Yeah. That technology spend has gone elsewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the long tail is the technology spend that comes out of these programs.
How do you plan for the number of people you need and how do you scale up when you win a big contract?
Yeah, we've invested in our, in FutureGov itself, we've invested quite strongly in our centre over the last couple of years as a result of that, as a result of that scaling. So I have a people director, a recruiting manager as well, and they constantly, we currently, I believe, have a roughly 200 people on a backlog that we're keeping warm for as and when we need it. We have an initiative that you can read about on our blog, which is called FutureGov Experience, FGX, and that is very much focused on how do we bring a design mindset to employee experience in FutureGov and client experience as well. So we think very deliberately about what is it like to work at FutureGov or with FutureGov to make sure that we are increasingly the go-to organisation of our nature. We last week had 300 applications for one service design internship for £21,000 a year. So we're fairly well known and liked as an employer, I think. That probably shows me.
Okay. Just conscious of time. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Dom, thank you.
So I'm David Biden. I'm one of the founding partners of another company within the Panoply, not Binary. So as to some of the questions we asked earlier, I know what it's like to go through that IPO and that acquisition path, but I'm now the CEO of Human Plus. So Human Plus was really founded through some of the projects that we encountered as part of Not Binary. And over the 2.5 years that we were there working in and around government, we learned a lot of things. One of the first things that I learned was about keeping it simple in that first year of business. So we're a specialist robotic process automation company. That's all we do. And we're focusing just on the public sector for this first year. It's quite interesting with RPA. I'll come on to in a minute about how it can transfer, and coming back to your question earlier, across different sectors. It's probably one of the easiest things to transfer to different sectors that remains in the group at the moment. So what we did is when we started this, I'm just going to skip on. There was the reason behind starting this is John Manzoni, the head of the public sector, back in a talk in January 2018, set the stall out for government, essentially, by saying that RPA is going to be one of the key things that they invest in over the next few years. I mean, it's perfectly suited to government. You've got a lot of legacy technology. You've got a low productivity rate in some areas. And there's high volume, high transactional things. Since then, he's kind of puts money where their mouth is. The Automation Task Force has been formed within government. That's led by a gentleman called Ian Dalton, and that's actually come to appear in July this year. And probably one of the most interesting points that backs what John Manzoni was saying was the release last Friday from Crown Commercial Services to say that they want to set, well, it's actually a prior information notice to say they're going to set up a dynamic purchasing system for £80 million worth of automation services. Now, that will be in place by April next year. So we're fully aware of that. We're positioning ourselves to be as favourable as possible for when that comes up. So in terms of what we actually do, we took a hard look at RPA and the vendors that were in the market, the people that were implementing it. We spoke to a number of CEOs and senior leadership teams about what they were doing, mostly clients of NotBinary and things like that. And we saw that there, a lot of people were just implementing small point solutions. It's a bit of a challenge in the RPA market at the moment. Lots of people are just doing one process here, one process there. In a lot of cases, a lot of people are being displaced because of that as well, because they're looking at one singular thing. That then creates another challenge within the business because the sort of relationship between RPA and the rest of the business gets very tricky as soon as you've sort of displaced a few people by automating one process. So what we realised is we needed to come up with something else. So what was our entry to the market going to be? And we've really based it around what we've coined ethical RPA. And that starts with a proof of value model. So I'll come on to the details of the proof of value shortly, but we look at the whole organisation when we're looking at RPA. So instead of just point solutions, I've got a client at the moment that turned up and said, essentially, we've got 30 people that process invoices. That's all they do all day long. Can you automate my invoicing team? Well, yes, we can. What are you going to do with the people after that? Well, we're not sure, but we'll probably get rid of quite a few of them. Okay. When I look on your website, there's 104 vacancies on there. So why don't we take a look at this? We can automate this point solution for you, but let's work with the team. Some of them will leave through natural attrition, but let's start to build a centre of excellence for robotic process automation within the organisation. Look at it as continuous delivery, not a point solution. That's probably the biggest differentiator that we look at the moment, looking at RPA as a continuous delivery that doesn't stop within the organisation. So a lot of what we do is we set them up for success themselves. We're looking to do about 90% of all first projects, 70% of the second, 50% of the third, as we upskill them and we move on to other clients and things like that. The third thing is that we're looking at long-term partnerships with people. I'll come on to some of the vendors that we've made partners with in the 9 months that we've existed. The three main vendors, UiPath, Blue Prism, and Thoughtonomy. But we're looking for clients as long-term partners as well. Those that are looking to do more than a POV. It's part of our qualification process, part of our investment process as we work with these people to go, okay, it's great that you're interested in this technology, but what are you going to do beyond one process? What are you going to do beyond the second process? The reason that we chose public sector to focus on is my background is public sector. Everybody that works at Human Plus, their background is public sector. Some of us have come from NotBinary, some externally. And we could see that it was a market well suited to it. And as you saw before, it was something that they were then looking into themselves. The Cabinet Office have a number of proof of values going themselves at the moment, but there's no real framework. There's no real one way of doing it. And there's very few professional services providers in the market that just do RPA. How do we get started with our clients? So first, a qualification process as part of the sales cycle. As I said, we speak to people, we look at the people that are looking to invest further in this, build a partnership with us. In terms of how we get those leads and opportunities, a lot of them come from the vendors themselves, from Blue Prism, from Thoughtonomy as such. We've taken a lot of time to work with the sales teams from those organisations to educate them on our proof of value model, to educate them on our price points and how we're different from other vendors in the market. So what it does, it sees us design, build, test and implement one process. So we sit down with the organisation, we choose one thing that's going to give them a return on investment, but nothing that's core to the entire business, as this is the first time for many that they're doing it. Secondary to that, we educate them. And we see ourselves as implementers as well as educators. The market, the technology's been around for a very long time. The market is still very young for RPA. So what this means is we work with stakeholders at the highest level, CEO, CXO, C-suite, that sort of thing, to educate them on what RPA is. It's not a silver bullet for eradicating technical debt within an organisation. Implemented incorrectly, it will create even more technical debt. We work with the people whose lives really are going to be affected by RPA. As I mentioned, a potential client speaking to us about the 30-person invoicing team. Well, what we need to do when we work with these people is we need to get the information from the people that do the job right now so that we can build that automation. So we have this agreement in place already with most of our clients that okay, we're going to do this, but what we're going to do is redeploy the people within our other areas. Productivity is our game. Our game is to raise the productivity of any organisation, and that's really why we're taking on. We build trust and we build relationships within that three-month period. So it's usually about 60 days. It's a fixed price, the POV. So it's a low market entry point, and we're seeing a lot of interest at the moment. We've done four of them so far since we've been set up. That's in our 9 months. We've managed to establish the process, build the relationships, the three key vendors, and deliver four proof of values already. Now, what we're looking to do in half two is convert those into the larger opportunities, those full-term, those longer-term opportunities, and obviously go ahead with more POVs with different clients. But this third point here, for me, is probably one of the most interesting in the POV process. So what we're trying to do is eradicate blockers. So in the times of delivering these four, I've spoke to unions about what RPA means for the workforce, why they should welcome it rather than rebuff it. I've spoken to a lot of IT security people about this technology, how it works. It's incredible the amount of questions we get. It sits on top of your current IT estate. It doesn't actually hold any data, the RPA systems that we use. So it's an interesting one for them, but it's usually quite easy to answer the questions. And we're really just using that 3 months, they're paid engagements, to build relationships with procurement, with IT security, with the unions, with the business, all of those sorts of people. So by the time we've come to the end of the three-month process, we've got one project designed, build, test and implemented in their environment. We've built a business case. We've helped them look across the rest of the organisation for anything else that can be automated. But we've also got through those blockers that should be the blocker to procurement by the time we've got to the end of the road there. So as I mentioned before, the tech's been around for a while, but the market's in its infancy at the moment. So we're around here, I would say. There's a few people doing things here in the cognitive RPA space. I think what we're going to see soon is a different type of organisation. We're going to see org charts that include bots as well as people. So you have teams of people, you have bots that work on enterprise-grade things, you have bots that assist people within their teams. So the market's got a long, long way to go yet. As I said, we're in the RPA phase. Cognitive RPA, that's more of your Thoughtonomy type products where it learns from the mistakes it's made, learns from the exceptions, learns from the errors, starts to build upon that. You've got the virtual agents, machine-based, intelligent enterprise, Skynet, Terminator, the singularity, end of the world, all the rest of it to that end. And that is all. Any questions from anybody?
How do you position the vendors? You gave us some idea there. You talked about autonomy in terms of cognitive.
Yep. Yeah,
presumably Blue Prism is about process, heavily sort of machine to machine, AA. Sorry, you don't do AA. UiPath.
UiPath.
Do you have a sort of a methodology whereby you say for this solution the best vendor is?
I wouldn't say so much a methodology. It depends on the requirements of the organisation. So some people are already up and running. I had a conversation yesterday with a client that has three UiPath developers have already bought the technology. Well, it's quite clear there. If leads are brought to us by one of the vendors, we have to stick with that vendor. But it really comes down, they all do slightly different things. So UiPath is an easier entry to the market. We see is very good for POVs, but has problems scaling after that. Blue Prism, enterprise grade, security grade, very, very safe. It's sort of big bank institution grade security. So we see that going down very, very well in the public sector market at the moment because of those reasons. Thoughtonomy, a higher price point, but it does a lot more. That's for people that have generally already had some sort of experience with RPA and are looking to go from there. So they tend to align themselves quite nicely to the requirements of the client. Yeah. So something else I just wanted to go back to as to being part of the panoply. What's been really interesting for me, as I said, I'm an entrepreneur. This is my third business, Methods Digital being one, not Binary the second. This is very different for me, being born into the panoply as a startup. It's great to have the access. I think it was yourself, actually, that had a question earlier about how do we work together. But to be able to work with the likes of FutureGov, Manifesto, more established businesses, to be able to lean on them and some of their experience as they've gone through this scale-up process is very, very beneficial. In addition to that, there's a certain amount of pipeline that comes directly to us from the panoply. And as a startup, that's something that you only really dream of. And being able to assemble a board of experienced people as well from day one, a fairly low price point because we're already in the panoply, has been very beneficial to us as well. Any more questions?
No, thank you very much. I think, in summary of that, we certainly see the human-centred approach as being the differentiator. When we, you know, the Human Plus as an entity has only been around for a few months, and yet when we went to Blue Prism and we talked about this, we were immediately offered the keynote in their EMEA kickoff, because nobody else was talking to them about the combination of the technology implementation alongside the change and organisational change management that needs to happen at the same time. You know, you've seen in the press lots of commentary on what happens to all these jobs, what happens to all these people, are we about to automate, are we at an inflection point in jobs? And we would certainly, you know, this is where our purpose and commercial imperatives come together. We're certainly seeing that purpose-driven approach drive many leads coming out of Blue Prism now as a consequence, which is great news for us.
Very much so. And interestingly, that's actually brought us into lots of leads. Sorry, am I ticking over? from the financial services sector, from Blue Prism, because they have actually been very keen to take up this approach as they've entered into a lot of this quite early. It's been given a bad rep, so to reintroduce us with this approach is something that they think will be very beneficial.
Thank you.
Real.
Great.
We're Green Shoot Labs. I'll quickly talk about the founders and then kind of what we do and so on. Tim, who is out there somewhere, has an interesting history with the Panoply, in that his team, Decent, so one of the Panoply acquisitions with the Decent agency. I was the technical strategy director at Decent. Started talking to Tim about chatbots and automation and artificial intelligence and where I thought things were heading. And that's what led to us putting together Green Shoot Labs. So we started within Decent, we started doing some work for clients, and then we put together Green Shoot Labs. My background is in artificial intelligence. Back when you couldn't say you were doing artificial intelligence because people wouldn't give you funding. So you had to say you were doing distributed problem solving or knowledge management or data science, but just don't say AI. It's a good mix, at least I think, of very product-focused, kind of commercially focused work, but I'm also quite academic, so stop me if I start getting into the details of things. And I'm want to plug my book, which up until a few days ago I was saying I'm writing it, but now I can say it's coming soon because it's actually finished and it's being edited, and that's me happy. Okay, so what do we do? We enable transformation through conversational applications and artificial intelligence, right? So conversational applications are all those things where you interact with a machine by the exchange of messages, so we're not pointing and clicking anymore or anything like that. We are talking to it in some form. And obviously, artificial intelligence is what lets us do some of the more complex types of interactions with conversational applications. Why? 2.9 billion active users across Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp compared to 2.4 billion monthly active users on Facebook, right? So you care about conversations because that's what people are increasingly doing more of on the web. Overall, 5.8 billion active users, and messaging is growing faster than social media. So you care about conversations because that's what users do, and you want to be able to interact with them where they are. It's also where work happens, right? Slack says they have more than 10 million active users daily. Microsoft Teams has 13 million active daily users. These are conversational collaboration platforms. They are tools that let us talk to each other, are kind of increasingly becoming our virtual workspace. It's where we log in and actually say, I'm at the office. So it's important to be able to build applications and build solutions around how and where people work. It's where devices are, right? We are forced smart speakers down our throat in every single way. There is a very clear reason. It's kind of one of the best ways to to get people onto your platform. It becomes part of your life. And I think there is, beyond kind of the numbers, there is taking a step back and looking at what computing is and what we have been doing. For the past 40 years, we have been pointing and clicking. And if you think what happened when we started pointing and clicking, that's Apple with the Mac. And technology companies are looking at that and saying, well, the company that's going to stop us pointing and clicking and will just allow us to talk is going to drive that next wave of transformation. And this is kind of, leave all the numbers aside, kind of all the hype and everything else, there is a much more basic force that is driving us towards conversations. And it's nice to think that up until now, we had to learn how machines work. We're finally at the point where we can start saying, well, machines have to figure out how we talk, and they have to be able to answer. Right. So that I think, is a very kind of underlying big driver, where you can start thinking of this computational fabric, which in my mind is absolutely Star Trek, and you walk into a room and you say, computer, do this. And we're not that far away from it. I mean, the other room I was in had a little board where you could start the slideshow and kind of switch on the projector and so on. And I can get it doing that with voice tomorrow. Right. So we're in a great place to do really interesting things. So that's the why of conversational AI. Now, what does GreenShoot Labs do? How do we try and solve this problem? There's kind of four things. It's an interesting space because there's a lot of excitement about it. You're talking artificial intelligence, the end of the world. It's not going to happen, don't worry. But there's a lot of work around helping companies think about what is an appropriate path through this. So there's work around strategy. People aren't used to build conversational applications, so we provide them with a methodology, and I'll talk a bit more about that. Then we also provide tooling. So we have an open source tool called OpenDialog, which helps people manage conversational applications, and I'll talk a bit more about that. And finally, the last piece that kind of ties it into the wider Panoply family is we may end up doing kind of a prototype and then scale that out, but that leads into learnings and wider transformation across the organization. So you go from thinking about the strategy, helping them do something that's going to provide learnings, and then tie that back to wider transformation. So let me talk a bit about OpenDialog because it's my baby and I'm very excited about it. OpenDialog is a conversation management platform. And the summary is that while there is a lot of tooling to do very interesting things with artificial intelligence and natural language processing in particular, there is very little that ties that together into a cohesive whole and says, here's how you can run it from an enterprise perspective. So an open dialogue is designed to fit right there. It's when, I'm going to give you some more specific examples, so I'll save kind of the long description, but it's when you need something that you just can't get anywhere else, and there's lots of these cases, and we'll see them. From a technology perspective, and I don't want to go too deep into it, there are some very interesting things. First of all, the way we design conversations is this semi-automated way where a user gives part of the conversation, but we know that conversations are extremely complicated things, so OpenDialog fills in the gaps and gives you all the cases where things can fail and helps you deal with that. And we do this in a way that is built for enterprises, right, where we know that there are big teams with different rights in terms of what they can access, what they can change, different policies, different security requirements, and so on. And also directly thinking about how conversation leads into action, which in this case, in the digital world, action means integration with other systems, right? So if I say switch on the projector, that's just not something here that understands what I said. It's something that connects into the overall system of this building that says, yes, Ronald is allowed to switch on the projector, and then it knows how to switch on the projector, right? So kind of right at the core of open dialogue is this, at the design level, is this mixing of conversation and action. And finally, the way we store data, and this is kind of one of the fundamental things that people get really excited about, is we can give you very deep analytics about what works and what doesn't, and I'm happy to talk about why that is actually the thing. The ideas behind it come from kind of my background in academia. It's we're implementing something called electronic institutions, which I'm not going to go into the detail with, but it gives us a very structured way to design conversations, because we design them as heterogeneous agent-based systems where some things are automated and they're bots and other things are human beings and they interact. And we actually have lots of tooling to model this. And the work we're doing with Open Dialogue right now is leading directly back into kind of contributions back into academia. And finally, it's open source. And it's open source because it gives us immediate access to a lot of organizations that would have difficulty with it in any other way. It gives organizations the security that this is something that they can pull in-house and manage their data. And it means that they own both their data and their process, and they're kind of free to really go ahead and scale on this, as opposed to saying, well, are we forever going to be dependent on this external vendor? We kind of, as I said before, at the lower level, we do integrate with some of those core technologies that give us the natural language processing capabilities. Okay, so the best part, results. This is kind of the latest bot we built, and it's actually a very simple bot. Brunel University came to us kind of late in the game, I think it was May or something, saying in 2 months, clearing is going to happen, and clearing day is crazy. Everyone is calling the university to see if they're eligible for a spot. Can we do something to reduce the wait? So we said, okay, we can build a chatbot for you. And it's a very simple chatbot. But what got Brunel really excited is the fact that they were getting it through Open Dialogue. So they were getting a platform that would let them build lots of other chatbots, because they have lots of problems like the clearing day, where there is some sort of event, there is ongoing support they need to give students, they have a development team, so they just need a partner that's going to help them along the process. So yeah, we built Brunella. I did not choose the name, apologies. And it was very successful for them. It reduced the amount of calls that they got on that day, and that translates to direct results, right? They've saved costs. But as I said, the most interesting thing is the fact that they're now on the Open Dialogue platform and they can start thinking of what else they can do. Cyber Helpline is one of the first bots we did, and this is a pretty complex problem. The Cyber Helpline is a charity that helps victims of cybercrime. And what the chatbot does is help the victim understand what sort of cyber attack they've just faced. And based on that understanding, is essentially a triage. So based on that understanding, is going to send them to an appropriate guide. So it's a complex problem from a technical perspective, because people come to you with all sorts of weird stories about what happened, starting from, well, since my new neighbor moved in, my Wi-Fi isn't working so well, and there's something with my bank account going on. And you kind of have to disambiguate all that space and figure out, well, is there a cyber attack going on here? Is there something else? Or they will say, you know, my files are encrypted and they're asking for ransom. It's kind of really interesting situations. So what we did is build for them a knowledge graph, an ontology that helps them treat an attack as a disease. So it has symptoms and it has markers, and we identify those markers and then figure out what the attack is. It was very successful for them. It was about 70% detection rate, so we get it correct in the first or the second try. Police forces are really excited about that because they don't know what to do about cybercrime. It's on the website of a couple of them, and there's a very interesting commercialization aspect to it where they're thinking of getting this engine that is now able to figure out cyber attacks and sell it as a service for small businesses to start with initially. BDO was another really good example. They came to us with a very simplistic idea of, well, an audit is a conversation between the auditor and the auditee. Can you turn that into a chatbot? And we said, no, that's a terrible idea because an audit is a really complex process, which is what they had kind of figured out, but they thought it was just because it was bad. They did a bad chatbot, and a better chatbot could do it in a better way. But what we ended up doing with them is saying, well, hold on, we can transform the entire audit process, right? So let's think about what is actually going on here. So we went through a pilot with them. We looked at what the opportunities are, built essentially kind of a proper digital tool for doing audits, and then looked at what opportunities that tool gives them in terms of structured data so that they can then analyze audits in a better way and help clients in the future. And kind of the end result of that when we released it, it's called LISA, which stands for Limited Statutory Audit, is that auditors were extremely enthusiastic about it. This was a really better tool for them, and the conversational aspect was essentially a support to the audit process because it's a long and complicated process, but there were questions around what does this do to the overall process commercially? What about the human touch and so on? So it was very interesting to see that kind of that sort of evangelism that needs to take place both within the organization and outside the organization when you're introducing automation. The good news is that overall, now BDO is extremely excited about this, and it's part of their 2020 program. It's kind of a core strategic initiative. So we will be working with BDO for a considerable amount of time, helping them take this. Currently, we're working with BDO Switzerland. We're talking with BDO Global, and it's kind of helping them take this across all their firms. And the last example, just to give you kind of an idea of the full range, is we are doing some work with Defense Science and Technology Lab around how can you use chatbots in very adverse conditions where you don't have a lot of time, there's lots of other things going on, and you need access to complicated information quickly. And this is very much at the research stage right now. It's a significant project for us. It's a two-year project. But it's the first time that they're looking at how they might use this sort of technologies. There are complex information integration problems. There is, apologies for the very academic diagram, but there is this, it's solving this problem of if I want to do a complex search, but I don't have a search interface, I don't have Google, I can't type a lot, I'm just talking to this thing. And right now, the way this happens is they talk to an analyst that has access to all the tools and does the search for them and comes back for the answer. So it's going straight to the data sources, which are distributed across different environments. And it's moving between what I'm searching to the specific document, to the specific piece of knowledge, back and forth. What's exciting for us is that this is very complex, deep research that's going to feed back into open dialogue, because all of this is kind of is set up for DSTL as well, as this is an open source project that they're doing with us. Good. I think that's it. I just had one last thing on automation, because I think it's easy to get lost in the details, and there's something about automation that I think is inevitable. The scale of the problems that we have is immense. Like the numbers, there's this website called Internet Live Stats, and it just keeps updating the numbers. And every time I visit it, I say, no, surely that's wrong. It's their methodology that is wrong. These are the numbers today, right? And then you look at some of the goals that we have as humanity. The UN says in order to be able to provide every child with primary and secondary education, we're going to need an additional 69 million teachers across the world. We only have 64 million teachers right now. So how do we bridge that gap? There is no other path other than automation. And if you look at every single problem we have, health, education, climate, as well as what we do in our organizations, it's automation. So to me, that's kind of the underlying driver of why I get excited about these things. Great, that's it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
What are the big challenges in terms of, you know, adoption of conversational AI? Is it, you know, you said you're getting the, you know, the machines to try and, you know, respond to us, but there's still got to be an educational process in terms of, you know, how we look to bridge that interaction, surely. I mean, just your perspective on that.
I think the biggest mistake we can do is try and go to a fully open-ended conversational paradigm from the get-go. What I talk about to people when we talk about conversational strategy is, you know, don't set yourself this impossible goal of recreating human conversation. It's just not going to happen. We are not there. What you need to do is kind of from a much more grounded service design approach, think, where does a conversational application fit? Where is that a better solution? And I call them applications precisely because they're little apps. Yeah. It's just that the main mode of interaction with them is this give and take message of a conversation. So for example, the thing we built for Brunel, it's a glorified form, right? And with form elements, and you select your A levels and your, but you do it in this really nice structured closed context. And that's what you go and solve all your other problems with. It's not about, you know, the Turing test and proving that this is a human. So, yeah. Then, as we go along this path, we are becoming increasingly better at solving some of those problems. So, you know, we will get to really interesting points. But there is a lot we can achieve without that.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on false positives on conversational AI.
We've had that a lot with the cyber helpline, right? Where it's not actually, it thinks it got it, but it didn't get it, or the other way around. I think part of it is back to design again. Partly you can't avoid it. I mean, if you're dealing with probabilistic systems, there's just mathematically, there's no guarantee that you can avoid it, right? There's something you can do in deterministic systems, but so you have to fall back to design. For example, what we do with the cyber helpline is we say, we think that this is an encrypting ransomware attack. An encrypting ransomware attack looks like this. Does that sound like what happened to you? Even though you just described what happened to you, right? But now we're educating you a bit more in the world of cybercrime and cyber attacks, and then we're asking for an extra confirmation with you. So we're working with the user to solve it. But you have to design under the assumption that you're going to get it wrong so that you can recover from it.
Sorry, a question internally, but it's one that would probably be good to just flesh out a bit more, was just how does open dialogue fit into the solutions that you've provided so far, and why was open dialogue important versus some of the other tools that are available?
So in, good question. In every single case, so you go with Brunel, right? They had built a couple of small bots using SaaS services, But the minute they had to integrate with the UCAS API to get the latest scoring and so on, all the SaaS services just didn't work for them. And they couldn't see themselves scaling there, while with Open Dialogue, they can see themselves having this internal capability that they can scale and do things. If you look at BDO, they're not going to send any of this audit data to any outside system. Plus, they need to guarantee certain strict regulations are adhered to. The only way they can do that is with an internal system that they manage. If you look at DSTL, well, we don't have the internet. We're out in the field, right? So it has to all work on its own. So it's kind of there is no other choice. And this is what I meant initially when I said, you know, Open Dialogue is for those situations where you need something bespoke and specific to your case. And if you think it through, kind of any sufficiently large organization actually has that problem because they can't have this depend on an external system that they can't manage. And they can't tell their clients, you know, all our training data is going through Google NLP and coming back out, and it's going to be fine.
Thank you, Ronald. So just to... I guess just to close out on Ronald's presentation, we believe conversational interfaces are the next big thing. And we want to position the group for that huge shift away from point and click. Open Dialogue is stands out far, way above anything else that's out there right now. The reason we've open sourced it is so that we reduce the friction around enterprise adoption, but we can certainly see this playing out in regulated industries pretty quickly, utilities and telecoms, and many other industries as well, which is why we've put the investment into it. We think it's the right thing for the long term. On that note, that's all of our presentation. So thank you all very much for attending. And you're all very welcome to stick around for the rest of the conference as well. If you do have time to go into the exchange track and come and see some of the presentations that are going on in there, which is particularly relevant to the Panoply. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
PO World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.